boy. Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah. Everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. We hope everybody is doing well today. I think my co-host is doing quite well today. Hello, Tim. How are you?
Well, good evening, Kel. Yes, I'm doing very well indeed. And how the devil are you tonight?
Infidelity fine, and I'm taking up pool playing now.
Is that right? Yes, a great game. It's something that I played a lot in my youth, and they do say that being good at pool is a sign of a misspent youth. But yeah, there you go. Can't have everything.
I need a new hobby. That's all.
Oh,
but
you
other
do.
Than that, yeah. I'm doing well. Things are going along swimmingly here. But what are we talking about today? Oh, hang on, Tim. Before we get too far, we do want to remind people, okay, we have a contest going on here.
Oh,
it's
yes,
a trivia
indeed.
Contest. If you can answer the trivia question, you get to win yourself a beautiful first edition Grievous Mendacious Mongery Takiya Artist coffee mug, courtesy of Tell Mama. So there you go, Tim. So I'm going to give out that question a little later on.
Well, that sounds really good. Yes, one of these mugs is going to be worth a great deal of money in the years to come. I feel, Kel, people will be passing these mugs down to their grandchildren and saying, "Back in 2014, there was a mendacious grievance mongering Takiya artist called Fiaz Magal, and he got his comeuppance, and this coffee mug is a memento of that stupendous time." And people will be these mugs are going to be changing hands, I feel sure, for hundreds of thousands of dollars in the dim and distant future. I feel sure, you know. People will be saying, "No, I don't want that Renoir. You can take that Picasso back. Put the Rembrandt back in the auction. Just give me that mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist coffee mug, and I'll die a happy man." That's what the people will be saying. So, yes, if you answer a trivia question correctly tonight, you too can be an owner of a mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist coffee mug with a picture of Fiaz Magal, the original mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist, on the front of it. So get your trivia hats on, everybody, and wait for Kel to give you the question.
And there you go. And you know what? I still have to read my coffee mug to get that phrase right, and I didn't read it this time, and I still have to read my coffee mug to get that mouthful out there. But you know what?
Oh, that's no problem.
It's brilliant writing.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if it's all the, as long as you get all the words in, it doesn't really matter what order they're in. I mean, they can be mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist, or even grievous, mendacious-mongering Takiya artist, and I'm sure our listeners will not worry about it too much in the slightest. But the original phrase, of course, is mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist, and I'm very pleased to see that phrase has entered the popular lexicon. I can't open my computer these days and look on the sites around the internet without seeing that phrase come up at least once. And I'm so happy. If nothing else comes of this case, at least we'll have managed to get that phrase around the world. I nearly did it myself there. Mendacious grievance, my
dear
Takiya artist. And for those of you who happen to have acquired a copy of the Birmingham Sunday Mercury, which is a weekly paper that we have here in Birmingham, if you fast forward to page 21, you will see an article in print in the Birmingham Sunday Mercury concerning yours truly, and the story of how the mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist came to occupy the position of fame that he currently does. It's a summary of my case. It's actually a very fair summary, actually, because I did wonder about the way in which the Birmingham Sunday Mercury might report it, but they were actually very fair. And if anybody wants to, I tried to look in the online version of the Sunday Mercury, and I can't see the article. But if anybody's able to send me their email to my address at catstrangler101@gmail.com, I will happily drop a scanned copy of the scanned file relating to this article. I'll send it over to them. So yeah, I can send you a scanned copy. Just send me your email address to catstrangler101@gmail.com. And I'll do that. As I say, I would normally have expected the Sunday Mercury to put something like that in their online version as well. But the last time I looked, they didn't appear to have done so. So if anybody's interested, there it is. And it's even got a picture of me in there. Not, I have to say, I've got one of those faces that people tend to describe as being very good for radio. But nevertheless... Nevertheless, it's there. So you've got my big smiley face in the picture, which you can cut out and keep, and you know, hand down to your daughter, your granddaughters and grandsons, together with the mendacious grievance mongering Tikiartist coffee mug, which you'll be able to get your win. And don't forget, if you don't want to wait for the trivia competition, or if you want to purchase, or if you want us to send one of these mendacious grievance mongering Tikiartist coffee mugs to you, just a small donation to the Cat Strangler 101 Legal Defence Fund, which you can find on my blog at the top of the show highlights, or indeed on the Liberty GB website. You'll see a little button about halfway down the page on the right hand side, saying donate to Tim Burton's Legal Defence Fund. A small donation would be fine. I'm not asking for anything specific at all, because I think that would be wrong. But if you then just let me know, by again sending me an email to catstrangler101@gmail.com, we'll make sure you get a mendacious grievance mongering Tikiartist coffee mug winging its way over
but
to you in short
order.
They
have to be here at the show to answer the trivia question too.
Yes, indeed. So, we better move on to the trivia question. So, over to you, Kel.
Yeah, let's do that. But, ladies and gentlemen, all the links are right there in the show notes, and for you archive listeners, you will find them too. Now, the trivia question today is, go up and take a look at the slides. Everybody, scroll up. Go on. Hurry up. Get up there. Take a look at the slides. There is going to be a picture you'll come across, and there is a happy couple holding a feline baby. Who's the happy couple, and what's the name of the cat that they're holding? So that is the trivia question. And Prince George, no, does not count. You have to name the cat. Who is that cat? So there is your trivia question for today. And if you get it, please call in at 347-237-4318. Press 1 on your dial pad so I know you want to come on the air and answer the question. And Tim and myself will take your details, and your coffee mug will be on its way if you get the question right. There you go, Tim.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very much. And have we got a flood of callers on the line just waiting to dial in and say, oh, miss, please, miss, it's me. Please ask me first, miss, ask me first. Have we got a flood of callers in yet? Or is this a trivia question too far? Find out at the end of the show. I think somebody will get it. I'm pretty sure they will.
I'm pretty sure they will, too. And Eric in the chat room, he did make a suggestion, but no, that is not it, Eric. Sorry, it's not Grumpy.
And
if you have had one in the past, you cannot call in and win again. Sorry. One prize per caller. There you go.
That's it. One prize per caller, per show, perhaps. So there we go.
There
you, right.
Yeah. Now, yeah, moving into our topic at hand here. I came across this letter, Tim, and I wasn't quite sure how I wanted to deal with it. But it was a letter written by Sergeant Eddie Jeffers. He was stationed in Iraq. He was a USA soldier. He wrote this in 2007, and he has since passed away. He was killed in the Afghan-Iraq War. But he wrote this letter, and he was lamenting about the lack of support by the American people for the U.S. troops. I kind of want to use that as a template to discuss how are we supporting our troops. I know in Canada we're not doing very well of late, and the Harper administration is trying to make some is trying to rectify that in the fact that our troops do deserve better treatment. In the United States, though, their benefits are being stripped. Their post-war treatment benefits are being stripped. It's just a real mess over there. But Eddie Jeffers, he wrote this article, and I found it rather surprising. But I'm going to read. I put a bit of a preamble of it in the show notes, guys. But this is how it starts out. I stare out into the darkness from my post, and I watch the city burn to the ground. I smell the familiar smells. I walk through the familiar rubble, and I look at the frightened faces that watch me pass down the streets of their neighborhoods. My nerves hardly rest. My hands are steady on a device that has been given to me by my government for the purpose of taking the lives of others. I sweat, and I am tired. My back aches from the loads I carry. Young American boys look to me to direct them in a manner that will someday allow them to see their families again. And yet, I too am just a boy. My age, not but a few years more than that of the ones I lead. I am stressed, I am scared, and I am paranoid because death is everywhere. It waits for me. It calls to me from around street corners and windows, and it is always there. There are the demons that follow me and tempt me into thoughts and actions that are not my own, but are necessary for survival. I've made compromises with my humanity, and I am not alone in this. Miles from me are my brethren in this world who walk the same streets, who feel the same things, whether they admit it or not. And to think I volunteered for this, am I ignorant to the rest of the world, or so I thought? But he goes on to discuss in this letter home, and that's what I'm calling it, Hope Rides Alone. I think it was a letter home, so let's call it what it is, a letter I written for him to that he sent home. But he's talking about the reception that the U.S. military receives when they come home, and the shoddy treatment by the government, and especially by the media, and the Cindy Sheehans and the Al Frankens. And he's saying, look, you know, if you don't walk in my shoes, don't denigrate me, and don't denigrate the troops that are out there doing a job to keep you safe. And I was thinking that it's an interesting premise that we could discuss, and that is, how are we treating our troops, especially in a theater of war where the enemy are nothing but cowards? They're sheep herders by day and they're jihadis by night. They do not follow the Geneva Conventions. Why is it that when a jihadist beheads an American and puts it on YouTube, that there is no outcry? But when an American doing his job shoots an insurgent, all of a sudden, there is a tribunal, and it's all over CNN, MSNBC, or CBS. Why is it that we are not giving our troops the support that they deserve? And that's what I'm thinking. I don't know that we do, Tim.
Well, I'm sure that we don't, actually. It's been something I've been concerned about for a long time in recent history with the conflict that we've had in the Middle East. And of course, it isn't just American soldiers that are subject to these indignities. We have exactly the same thing with British soldiers too. Now, I think it's worth remembering that this particular letter, and I'm just going to just check for a second. Yeah, here we go. I'm just going to drop this link to this article into the chat room before I carry on, so that if anybody wants to refer to it as I'm talking, then at least they've got the article in front of them. Oh, you may well have put it on the in the show highlights, Kel. I didn't actually look to see. But the point I was going to make was this was written in 2007, and that's before President Obama came to power. And of course, as far as Americans are concerned, well, America, the American military, things have only got worse since then. The American military has been subject to all sorts of indignities, as you say. I mean, what was true for what you mentioned about Canadian soldiers losing benefits, I think that's, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's also been true to a certain extent for the American military as well. And I remember in particular when we had the Fort Hood massacre, which I think was back in 2009 with Major Hassan. Is that right? Nidal Hassan? That's the guy, isn't it?
Nidal Hassan, yeah, the Fort Hood shooter.
That's right. The Obama administration designated it workplace violence instead of the terrorist activity that it obviously was. I won't go into the ins and outs of that particular incident too much now, because I'm for one thing, I'm sure all the listeners are familiar with it, and for another thing, I didn't want to delve into that specific incident, except to say that one of the things that I remember as the aftermath of that was, because it was designated as workplace violence, it meant that the families of the soldiers who were killed and injured there had restrictions placed, and I believe this was a consequence of the fact that it was designated workplace violence rather than terrorism. They had their benefits restricted, and I think in some instances there were unacceptable delays in getting any kind of compensation to the families. And in fact, I think in some places compensation was actually denied because it wasn't classified as terrorist activity. Now, that's an appalling way to treat the military. The military should, in my opinion, if you're going to have a military who are going to put their lives on the line for your country, the very least you can do is to compensate them over and above what might be expected for somebody in ordinary civilian life. So, for example, all right, well, they may not be paid as much as, say, a banker on Wall Street or a lawyer or something, but then when something like this happens to them, the government should leap into action and show by example that it values the military, because at the end of the day, they're reliant on goodwill of the military to do the job that, well, no, they're not reliant on the goodwill. The people who are in the military do it for honourable reasons, and they have a sense of duty towards their country, and they carry it out to the best of their abilities. But when something happens to them that's outside their control, the very least that should be expected is that there is no delay in making sure that they are taken care of if they're injured or they're incapacitated, that they're taken care of in the best possible way, that their families are supported, and that they don't have to suffer any additional stress because their loved ones have been injured or incapacitated. And, you know, if they're killed, if they make the ultimate sacrifice in the military on behalf of their country, then there should be absolutely no question that their families should never want for anything else ever again. But that sadly seems to be an ethic that is totally lacking. And it's not just the American administration that's guilty of this. I mean, we have seen the same thing over here recently in the UK, where soldiers who have been injured or killed, their families have had to suffer what I would consider unacceptable delays in getting the benefits and compensation that would be expected. And not only that, but the benefits and the compensation are often derisory in comparison with what might be expected in civilian working life. I'm thinking in particular, there was, I, now I might, I, I haven't got the exact link, so I'm doing this from memory, but there was a young soldier, I think, who was very severely injured. I think he lost three limbs, and his award, I think, was a couple of hundred thousand pounds. You might think, well, okay, that's perhaps not too bad. But in the same week, a civilian worker, who I believe was in the civil service, the UK civil service, was awarded twice as much money, about £400,000, for spraining her wrist when she was typing. And she filed a claim for, carpal tunnel syndrome, I think it's called. And she got a six-figure payout, which, as I say, I think was in the order of £400,000. And when you set that against the compensation that this poor soldier received, it's obviously that something is severely wrong with the priorities of governments when it comes to treating their military members. Now, it's an unfortunate thing, but I mean it isn't a new thing. I've done research into British military history, and I don't know about American military history, but even going back 200-300 years, it was still the case that soldiers who were killed and injured in the service of the country got treated far more shabbily than civilian workers who didn't have to put their lives on the line in the same fashion. So, I mean, that is certainly a constant thing, but it's thrown into sharp relief these days when you get other indignities that are put in the way of the military, such as the rules of engagement, which mean that American soldiers have to walk around Iraq or Afghanistan with empty magazine cartridges or without a bullet in the chamber, so that they don't accidentally shoot somebody who's planting an IED 100 yards away. Mm. I mean, that's just crazy, you know. They should, if they're going to be out on patrol, you've got to give them all the tools that they need to defend themselves and their comrades. And if it takes a second or whatever it takes to put a bullet into a chamber from a magazine, and that's a second that you can't bring the weapon to bear and to fire off around at somebody who's putting your soldiers, your compatriots' lives in danger, then, you know, that's a second too long. And it, all right, the downside might be that you'll accidentally kill a terrorist as he's planting a bomb when you should really have given him the opportunity to at least fire back at you, you know, very sportingly. Well, I think that's entirely wrong. I think we're conducting wars with completely the wrong focus. If you go into a war at all, my view is that if it was me that was running the show, which obviously never will be, but if you're going to go into a war, you go in to win. You don't go in to pussyfoot around. And that might be an old-fashioned way of looking at things, but nevertheless, I think if all you're going to do is send soldiers in there with big targets painted on their backs for the locals to shoot at them, you shouldn't be sending them in there at all. And if you are going to put them into that sort of position, then you might at least give them a little bit of additional support, like better equipment, making sure they've always got the equipment they need for the job. Again, I don't know about the US. I imagine it's similar in the US, but in the UK, the Ministry of Defence are remarkably stingy when it comes to allocating money to make sure that soldiers have got the right sort of equipment they need. I mean, I could go on and on, but I'm going to draw breath in a moment and hand the mic over to you, Kel. But what I would want to say, first of all, is that I think it would be a great thing if we didn't have to send our soldiers out to war at all. But if we do send them out to war, then we ought to at least be in a position, as far as we possibly can, to make sure that the war we're fighting is one that we're going to win. And if we're not going to go in there to win it, we'd better have a very good reason to keep those soldiers over there instead of bringing them home. But I'll hand the mic back to you, so give me a chance to draw breath and give maybe our listeners a chance to reflect on it and put some things in the chat room.
Well, what I'm thinking, too, in that when I'm reading this article, I mean, it was written in 2007, and Barack Hussein Obama hadn't even entered the minds of the American people. This is under the George W. Bush administration, in which he wrote this letter. Now, George Bush, he did show a lot of support for the troops, unlike Barack Hussein Obama. But that is not restricted to the United States. I find it's rather global. I find, though, that in the West in general, and it's not just, like I say, it's not just the United States, ladies and gentlemen. It's happening in Canada. It's happening in the UK. It's happening in Australia, in that our governments are really abandoning these people, these men and women in uniform. But something else that's going on is that we're abandoning them, too. We're abandoning our men and women in the uniform. When they come home, we treat them less than stellar. They deserve our utmost respect, and they're not receiving it. And I don't mean the American people or the Canadian people or the UK people. We love our troops, and we show it every single day. It is the media, like the CNN or the MSNBC or the CBS, and they report on the atrocities of an American soldier trying to save his platoon by shooting an insurgent in a tree, because that insurgent is there hiding, and he's got an AK-47, and he is gunning for that platoon, and they shoot him out of that tree. And what happens? They get taken to a tribunal. That's what happens to the soldier. And the CNNs and the MSNBC and the CBS and the BBC and the CBC, all they can say is, oh, look at how the soldiers are treating the civilians. They're not civilians. They're insurgents. They're farmers by day. They're Taliban by night. What the hell are our soldiers to do? But when somebody is beheaded, Daniel Pearl, when he is taken captive, Nick Berg, when they're taken captive and they're beheaded and it's put on YouTube, nothing, crickets, nothing at all. So you know what? It's not the American people. It's not the Canadian people. It's not the UK people. It's the media as well. The media is the huge culprit, and the media feeds into the administrations that treat our soldiers like crap when they come home, and they don't get the benefits that they deserve. They don't get the treatment that they deserve. They get nothing. They get treated like garbage. You know what? Some of them, they don't even get their jobs back. These people enlist voluntarily. We don't have conscription. These people are fighting for our countries. They're volunteering to protect our borders and protect the people within them. And they leave their civilian jobs. And you know what? Some of them, when they come back, that job is not there for them. And they have nowhere to go. And this is the fault of our administrations. And this is certainly the fault of the media. And I think maybe I better take a breath, Tim.
Well, no, you're quite right, Kel. It is largely fault of media, but you're right in that the media and our political elites are working hand in glove to try and present a picture to the people which is out of sync of reality. All right, those more cynical listeners that we have in our chat room might well say, well, what else is new? But nevertheless, I think it's worth repeating a time and time again, because we don't want to forget that the problems that we currently experience are made 10 times worse by the disinterest and cluelessness of our political elites on a large number of occasions, and with the active complicity of the mainstream media helping along on most of those occasions as well. One particular thing that springs to mind with what you just said was, of course, the case of the Royal Marine back in December, Alexander Blackman, I think, working from memory. I should really have all these names at my fingertips, so apologies if I make any mistakes as I'm talking to you, ladies and gentlemen, because this is all from memory. But Marine Blackman was prosecuted for shooting dead an Iraqi insurgent who had, up until a few seconds previously, been an active combatant trying to kill him and his platoon, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, this guy was injured, and the Marine, against Geneva Conventions, it might be said, put a bullet in him and finished him off, rather than allow him to live. Well, okay, there are people who would argue that the Geneva Convention is there for a purpose. There are also other people, myself included, who would say that when something like that happens, you've got to keep it in context. And it's very easy for people who are trying to run a war from an armchair thousands of miles away to make these decisions and say, oh yeah, that was wrong, that shouldn't have been allowed, let's prosecute him. And instead of, you know, look at what had been happening in the days and weeks running up to that incident, where I dare say that Marine and all his compatriots were under a great deal of stress from the conditions that they were being expected to work under. Conditions, I might add, that could result in any of them being killed at any moment. And when you live life on a knife edge like that, you cannot be expected, in my view, to always take sit down and decide what happens in a particular set of circumstances and try and make a decision which accords with the Geneva Convention every time. I mean, that just isn't a practical thing to do. You do what you think is right under the circumstances at the time, and then what you expect is that your compatriots and your superiors support you in what decision you took, taking everything into account that led up to that. Now, it's my view in that particular case that Marine Blackman was very shabbily treated, and he's currently serving a long sentence in the military prison, I believe, in England. I haven't got the article in front of me, which is why I'm slowing down a bit, but it was just an example I wanted to make to say that there are far too many people out there who are willing to pass judgment on our military, and they're really not in a moral position to do so, because first of all, a lot of the people are the ones that made very bad decisions to send soldiers out there in the first place, put them in untenable positions with a fraction of what they need in the way of equipment to operate properly, in an environment where they are likely to be shot and killed by the very people they are trying to protect. And I'm not just talking about the locals who, as you say, are farmers by day and jihadists by night. In a lot of instances where you get the so-called green on blue casualties, these are people who have been conscripted. They're supposed to be working alongside the British and the Americans in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And some of them, when they get a gun in their hands and they decide to turn it onto their British or American compatriots, I mean, that leads to a very, very tense environment. If you don't, you know, it's one thing when there's people that you know who are out there behind a corner in the street or hiding behind a tree in a field or something, when they're trying to kill you, that's one thing. But when you've got to worry about when your own people might suddenly decide to go jihad on you and unleash a clip full of ammunition and kill you and several of your soldiers, that leads to a very, very tense environment. So if mistakes are made, and I'm not passing judgment on this particular instance with Marine Blackman to say, was it a mistake? Should he have done it? Should he not have done it? But the fact that he did it, I think, should be set in context against the background that we're expecting our young men and women to fight in. And I really cannot, for the life of me, understand why we don't have somebody with enough clout to say, you are not going to prosecute our soldiers in this fashion for doing their job when you yourselves have put them in an untenable position with very little equipment fighting under desperate circumstances. Now, all right, there may be occasions where you have to send soldiers in to do a very difficult job under difficult conditions for a very good operational reason, but it seems to me that the strategy that we have when we're sending our troops into Iraq or Afghanistan seems to be one rather than a long-term goal which everybody can see and identify with. It seems to be one of hope for the best, and you know, if something happens, we'll deal with it later. And that's just not good enough. We should not be sending our young men and women to fight and die under those circumstances. But it when incidents occur, we should certainly not be prosecuting them if they take the life of a terrorist or insurgent, or even a suspected terrorist insurgent, and it turns out to be a mistake. Well, okay, it's a mistake, but it is war, and to treat them as if it was exactly the same as committing murder in a civilian environment back home, and that's just quite wrong.
I like what Agador texted in the chat room, and this is from Richard R. Marcinko, I believe that's how it's pronounced. He once wrote, "If we ever go to war with the Swiss, we'll obey the Geneva Convention." And while you were discussing Marine A, that was what he, Alexander Blackman, before it was just disclosed who he was referred to in the press as Marine A. And he is appealing his conviction, and he should. We have so many soldiers, Tim, that are incarcerated because they were simply doing their job. And what comes to mind to me is the Leavenworth 10, which we refer to. And that includes people like Michael B. Hanna, John Hatley, Corey Claggett, whose mother I've had on my program in the past. Corey Claggett's mom has joined me to talk about her son, Corey. We have Evan Vella, Lawrence Hutchinson's the third, Williams Hunsaker, all these people, Clint Lawrence, all these people, all they were doing their jobs as soldiers, and what they got was a court-martial and a prison sentence. Corey Claggett, for example, is facing like 20 years. The same, all of these young men, these are young men. Corey Claggett was... he was just a kid. These people enlist to protect us, and this is how they're treated by our government? I don't get that, Tim. And we, you know, it's the United States, it's in the UK, but in Canada too. We've had Canadian soldiers incarcerated for doing their job, and that was killing the insurgents. So that's why I like what Richard Marcinko said. If we ever go to war with the Swiss, we'll obey the Geneva Convention. Until then, take a hike, let the soldier do their jobs, and let's get it done. What happened to our men? What happened? Did we lose them all during World War II? Like, what on earth is going on? When did our soldiers all of a sudden become social workers? Why do we have to mentor the ANA, for example, the Afghan National Army? Why do we have to mentor them? Why do we have to remove our boots when we enter a tent because we're having a sit-down with an imam, and then we have to remove our helmets, and somebody comes along and cleaves that soldier in the head? Why are we doing this? This is not war. This is social work. I don't want to change the hearts and the minds of the people who are trying to blow me up. I'm sorry. I want to go in. I want to take out. That's it. Get in there. Let the soldier do their jobs and get them out safe and sound and get them home and treat them with respect.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd get mad about this topic, but I am.
Well, yeah, and quite rightly too, Cal. The whole premise that we have put our soldiers over there, not to be soldiers but to be social workers, is completely flawed, and we shouldn't be following it. If we're in a position where we've got to turn our soldiers into social workers, then somebody at the top has to ask some pretty hard questions about what the hell we're doing over there at all in the first place. Now you mentioned the Afghan National Army and the fact that we've got to be hypersensitive to these guys, because if they get offended, you know, they'll pick up a gun and they'll shoot us, or they'll shoot the soldiers that are there. Well, if that's the case, why are we training them at all? We should be treating them all as the enemy, and we're never ever going to win hearts and minds. This is a completely fallacious concept. And of course, part of the problem is that the policy making of not only the Obama administration, but the UK administration and the Ministry of Defence and all those who are involved in decision making in making foreign policy and executing it, they're all working from a completely false premise. And the false premise is that the hearts and minds of Iraqis and Afghans, I don't know if that's so much about Iraqis, but Afghans Muslims in general in the Middle East, those hearts and minds are not to be won. Those hearts and minds, by and large, are always going to be on the side of the Muslim Ummah against the infidel. And no matter what we do, we are always going to be seen as the infidel. Now, if that were, you and I, Kel, and I'm sure the listeners in our chat room are fully aware of this, and we understand that there is this division between Muslim and non-Muslim, between Darul Islam and Darul Harb, and that it's the duty of every devout Muslim to do what they can, no matter how small, to help advance the cause of Darul Islam at the expense of Darul Harb, which is why we're seeing what we're seeing around the world every day. And if our political elites just stopped trying to make up fantasy policies on misguided principles such as winning hearts and minds, they would see that too. And then they would totally change their policies, if they saw that, and conduct the war on the basis of reality instead of on the basis of fantasy. Because conducting any kind of process using fantasy as your guide is never going to end well. But when it's something as important as foreign policy and executing wars in foreign countries, you'd better have a good grip on what you're doing. Fantasy is not only going to end badly, it's completely unforgivable. It behoves people in these kind of positions of authority to do due diligence and to say to themselves, how much do I really understand about this situation? But yeah, Most of them don't. They rely on advisors who I feel are advising them badly, and there is no reflection, there's no anticipation of, well, what could be the root cause that explains everything that we're seeing. They're not looking at that. And then you get people like David Cameron saying Islam is a religion of peace, and he bases all his decisions on that statement. So when two Muslims in the street in Woolwich last May slaughter a fusilier, Lee Rigby, he comes out and says, oh yeah, Islam is a religion of peace, and what these guys did was just a distortion of Islam. Nothing to worry about here, folks. You can go back to sleep. That's what I mean about fantasy policy making based on unrealistic judgments, because he hasn't done the due diligence. He should, when faced with what is an obvious and growing threat of Islam everywhere in the world, not just the UK, he should have executed due diligence and informed himself a little bit more about what is the driving force behind the Islamic ideology. I'm quite certain he's never done anything like that. And he's just taken the view that, well, it's not going to be my problem after the next election. You know, I'll probably retire, and all I have to do is just keep the lid on it until next election, and everything will be fine. Well, it probably will for him. But for everybody else who's had to live with the consequences of his decisions, they're not going to be fine at all. And I think that's an appalling way to run a country. And he's not alone, of course, because most of our Western leaders operate in exactly the same way. But these actions have real life consequences. They result in the unnecessary deaths of our soldiers, and it's nothing short of criminal. And again, another reason for when political sanity returns to the political landscape, I should say, we ought to be drawing up a list and explaining to people like David Cameron that their actions are going to have consequences for them too, and they should be tried a variety of offences up to and including war crimes for the actions that they refused to take because they couldn't be bothered to do the due diligence in the first place.
I find it very distressing, though, when I read the, just getting back to what I, how I feel about the media reportage, it bothers me deeply. And I just put a link in the chat room for everybody about we're more or less discussing the treatment of our soldiers, and we're touching upon their imprisonment for being a soldier. And there was one case in Canada here, Tim, and this involved Captain Robert Semereau, and he was dismissed from the Army because he was doing his job. But he was spared a stint in prison. He did not go to prison, but he is still filing an appeal. That is still under appeal. And that there was a wounded insurgent. He was severely wounded, and Robert Semereau shot him, and it was classified as a mercy killing because this soldier, his legs were blown off. Not the soldier, I'm sorry, the insurgent. His legs were blown off. He was bleeding out, and he was pleading, please put a bullet in my head and kill me, because it's obvious that this insurgent was going to die anyway. And Robert Semereau, he acted out of mercy and put a bullet in his head, and for that he faced a court-martial. He faced a tribunal. What would we do? See, when we send our men and women off to war, ladies and gentlemen, we don't know what they're going to see. We don't understand what's going through their minds and how they're going to react. Robert Semereau was acting out of mercy. This insurgent who was trying to kill him and his platoon, he showed mercy. Do you think the enemy would show the same compassion towards one of our soldiers if they were lying there in the street? And they were mortally wounded, and they were going to die, and they're in agony? No. What they would do is that they would turn it into a Black Hawk Down and drag the bodies through the streets while yelling, Allahu Akbar! That's what the enemy does. We are civilized. We are Western. We are military. We are men and women in that military. We show compassion. We try our level best, but believe me, when it comes down to either him or me, believe me, I want the Western soldier to come out victorious. And that means putting a bullet in the head of an insurgent. I really don't care. And when they come home and they want to, the media totally denigrates them, that their actions, their service, I think I have a bit of an issue going on here. And Tim?
I'm just reading this particular article that you mentioned, this Canadian captain. I suppose you could always argue ethics back and forth until you're blue in the face when it comes to mercy killing in a war zone. But I don't, I certainly don't think that his actions warranted that kind of punishment under any circumstances. The soldier in question, as I understand it, took a decision which I felt was morally and ethically justifiable, and there wasn't a downside in as much as if he hadn't undertaken those particular actions. It's highly unlikely that this insurgent would have lived in any case. So it's not as though he'd seen this guy with maybe, I don't know, a scratch on his arm or something and decided that he was going to put him out of his misery. This guy, as you say, was bleeding out. He probably wasn't going to last much longer. And I thought it was an ethically courageous decision that he took, certainly not one that should result in a tribunal which ruins his career. I think that's totally over the top. But again, it comes down to a lot of people in who are separated from the action and make these judgments are doing so because of a false premise. And I think a lot of it does come down to them thinking that they'd best be seen to at least be conducting the war in an honourable manner in in so that it will be seen as an honourable thing in the eyes of the local population. Because if the local population gets the wrong impression of how the Western military can conduct themselves, this is how the theory goes anyway, then there will be more animosity from the locals towards the soldiers than there would be otherwise. Well, I don't think you can make that kind of judgment anywhere that you're operating in a Muslim country, because Muslims will always regard soldiers of the American Army or British Army or whichever Western imperialist power, if you like, sends their soldiers over there, they will always be seen as the enemy. And it wouldn't matter if we sent our soldiers out there with pop guns instead of real guns that can kill people, and told our soldiers that no matter what the locals do, you're not allowed to injure them in any way. That would not win hearts and minds of the local people. They would still regard them as the enemy and be quite happy to kill them with any means possible, even though they knew that the soldiers had had, this is obviously a hypothetical example, even though they knew the soldiers had no means of fighting back. So I think the whole premise of hearts and minds should not be informing people who are making these judgments, but that seems to be exactly what's happening. And it would be far better if we accepted that sometimes soldiers in the field have to make difficult decisions. There may be ethical arguments in favour of doing of one course of action and also against that course of action. But I think if you take it to the extremes that this particular example shows, it's entirely wrong, because it sends out a message: our soldiers have very low value in the eyes of the superior officers and the people who are making these political decisions back home. And that is just not a good thing. You want the soldier, if you're going to have an army that is going to fight on behalf of your country, you want him to do so in the most motivated way possible. And it seems to me that the actions that of our political elites, and it has to be said, our mainstream media and all the people in the military, judiciary and so on, that take part in these courts martial and so on, it seems to me that their actions are designed to totally demotivate the military. And that's a terrible thing to do to people who have volunteered to give their lives in the service of the country. It's a criminal thing to do. I mean, this is just one example. I'm sure there are dozens, but that's my two cents on it for the moment, and I'll pass the mic back to you, Kel.
And a brilliant assessment, as usual, on your part, Tim. But what we're going to do is that we are at the top of the hour, so we're going to take a break. And what we want to do is Tim has an article here, and it's a very fascinating article from Fahrenheit 211. It's always someone else's problem when it comes to Islam, isn't it? And Tim is going to dissect that. We'll both be discussing that. But just to remind you, we have a contest going on here, guys. You know, go up there at the top of the page. There's a happy, smiling couple holding a baby, and it's not Prince George. Who's the happy couple, and what's the name of the cat? And we're going to take that break and see everybody back here in 4 minutes. Here we go. Oh, we'll start up. Here we are. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Kim Burton and Kel Fritzy. The first hour, we were discussing the treatment of our military by the media and by our governments. And now, though, we're going to move into a different topic. And this one is rather fascinating. And I like this article that you sent, Kim. This is from Fahrenheit to 11. It's always someone else's problem when it comes to Islam, isn't it? And that is really quite true. It seems to be that that's the way it is. And this one is pertaining to the Islamic prison population in particular, isn't it, Tim?
It is. And this article I quite like, if only for the reasons, for lots of reasons, but particularly for the reason that in the very first paragraph, the phrase mendacious grievance mongering Turkiyah has found a place. So it caught my eye straight away. But that aside, it's quite interesting from statistics from the Muslim population of British prisoners. It shows that it's doubled in a decade. Now, we might say, well, that can't be right, because everybody knows that Muslims are the most law-abiding people on the planet. So what's going on? It must be Islamophobia. But I'll let you summarize what the article is drawing on, which is a summary from the independent newspaper in the UK, and we'll take it from there.
You've got it. Now, the news that the Muslim population of British prisoners has doubled in a decade has been greeted by whining, excuse-making, and a blast of mendacious grievance-mongering takiyah from Islamic groups.
I love it.
Now, the independent newspaper said that the number of Muslims in the prison population has more than doubled to nearly 12,000 in a decade, figures from the Ministry of Justice show. Now, the dramatic rise prompted calls for ministers to investigate whether police and the courts are treating Muslims more harshly, with some suggesting the rise is due to, oh, here we go, Tim, money shot, Islamophobia.
Yeah, yeah.
Boy,
I know, the scourge of modern times.
And there's that word again. Now, Muslims represent only 4.7% of the population in England and Wales, according to the most recent census. Yet 1 in 7 prisoners, which sits at 14% in England and Wales, is a Muslim, according to the statistics. All right. Now, in some jails, the proportion of Islamic inmates is more than one-third, and in Whitmer, or Whitemore, Tim, Category A prison in Cambridgeshire, it is as high as 43%. I'm going to stop it there. And what is a Category A prison?
Well, I think Category A is the highest the highest security category, and you would normally only expect people who have been sentenced for really serious offences to occupy a Category A prison. In the UK, you have four categories, A, B, C, and D, and they rank in order of seriousness of the crime. So somebody who's, say, in prison for burglary might be a Category D prisoner. Somebody who's in prison for cutting off the heads of his next-door neighbour's family with a chainsaw might be slightly higher in a Category A, and then there are various categories in between. So that's broadly speaking how it's divided here in the UK. I'm sure there are similar ways of dividing prisoners in most countries, but that's how it would be done in the UK.
It's an interesting, though, that the very first thing out of the independent newspaper article is that there is discrimination against Muslims, and that it's due to a rise in Islamophobia. I find that rather hilarious myself. No, it's not Islamophobia if they really are trying to kill you, as Bonnie of Burning Islam says.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
Oh, It's amazing. The Muslim prison population has increased from 5,502 or 7.7% in 2002 to 11,729 in 2013 to 14%, and is set to continue rising rapidly because of the large numbers of Muslim teenagers in youth jails. Now, Tim, I implore you, please explain to the listeners, what is the largest growing demographic in the UK right now?
Well, the largest growing demographic, that's a tough one, Kel. Well, I think it might possibly have something to do with Muslims. Now, call me old Mr. Cynical, if you like, but I think that the fact that there is a rising demographic of Muslims might have something to do with this. But it's not just the rising demographic. It's the fact that they have a moral and ethical outlook which differs quite substantially from the outlook that we brought up in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Our morals and ethics are quite different. So somebody might say, well, given there's all this Islamophobia going round, and given that there's a lot more Muslim teenagers, you're bound to see a lot more Muslim prisoners. But no, it isn't just that. In fact, those are really just red herrings, I would suggest. I don't for a moment believe that our judicial system, our courts and our police are suffering from any form of Islamophobia at all. In fact, quite the reverse. If you look at the way that the police and the courts treat Muslims, which is to say with kid gloves, it's very difficult, well, not impossible, but it's difficult for a Muslim to get themselves arrested for a lot of offences where a non-Muslim would really have the book thrown at them. And those sort of things could be, well, a whole range of offences, and I could give dozens of examples, such as, for example, assault on, or even racial assault, like we saw not long ago with four girls of Somali origin who beat up a non-Muslim girl in the street, pulled her hair out, and the judge said, well, I'm not going to sentence you to prison because you had been drinking and you're obviously not used to it in your country, and they were allowed to walk free. Now, if that was reversed and you had four non-Muslim, well, whether it was girls or males is irrelevant, I think, but if they had attacked a Muslim and pulled her hair out, you'd never hear the end of it, and they would have had custodial sentences, substantial custodial sentences, I might suggest. So the courts and well, in this instance is the courts, but certainly I'm sure it's the case as well. They're treading very carefully and treating the Muslim community with kid gloves. So Islamophobia is not an issue, quite the reverse. In fact, if you took the kid glove aspect out of the equation, you would probably find that there would be even greater numbers of Muslims in prison because they are committing more imprisonable offences. It's nothing to do with Islamophobia whatsoever.
So that's what I find fascinating about that, and the chat room is quite busy about that. I think that everybody in our chat room would certainly agree, and that includes Agador, Anna, Bigfoot, Sarabella, Jeff of English Defense League Radio, I Am the Universe, our guests, Moving Forward, the Captain, and Vorpalbyte, you and myself, Jeff. Jeff? Hey, what's your name? Hey, who are you? Who are you? Mommy, where am I?
What's my name? Where am I? What's my name?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, I do implore you. I do like 9 shows a week, and that's okay. You know what? I call Rooster Tim, so you know what? Hey.
Well, I'm...
Oh, boy. Now that I'm totally blushing here. You know what, though? I'm going to leave that. I'm going to put that in a blooper reel, Tim. It'll be funny.
Well. Yeah.
I hope you'll see the humor in it when I put it in the blooper reel. But, yeah, this article, though, is absolutely amazing. And what they were doing, too, is that the Fahrenheit 211, they were putting it in italics from the independent newspaper because they were doing the quoting verbatim. And then now we get into what the Fahrenheit 211 response is. Now, despite it being quite obvious to me and anyone who has spent any time in some of Britain's more Islamized areas, why are there more Muslims in prison? Because they are committing more serious and prisonable crime. That has not stopped the Islamophobia whiners from ululating wildly and desperately trying to deflect attention away from that fact. Now, the Indy quoted three Islamo whiners in their story. So let's look at each one of them. And, Tim, I love this. This is from Musami Qureshi, a senior lecturer in criminology and criminal justice at Salford University, and he had this to say. Young Muslim men are under the official gaze from their school days onward. They have the lens of the state turned on them. Certain populations can become suspect populations in the eyes of the law enforcement agencies. And, well, you know what? I don't know what to say about that, you know.
Well, yes. Fahrenheit 211, of course, has an answer to that particular conundrum, might say. I couldn't have put it better myself, Kel. I couldn't have put it better myself. But yes, quite right. It's nothing to do with certain populations becoming suspect populations for no reason at all. As Fahrenheit 211 says in the following paragraph, that the followers of Islam are much more liable to be criminal or hostile to the values and mores of the host society, which is something we talk about quite a lot on this show and on other Blog Talk radio shows. The values and ethics of the Islamic ideology are completely contrary in a lot of instances to those values and ethics of Judeo-Christian ideology. So it's hardly surprising if we have a civilization which has been set up on Judeo-Christian grounds and traditions, incorporating Judeo-Christian values, morals and ethics, mm-hmm. that if you introduce a large number of people whose values and ethics run counter to that, they are likely to be breaking more laws because they are going to have a completely different idea of what is right and wrong. So, and of course, it's not just in the UK, although this particular article refers to the UK. There's also a note on in this article to say that, funnily enough, strange to relate, this is also true in other European countries. And they give an example of Holland, where Muslims are overwhelmingly more likely to be involved in crime. This is in Holland, 22 times more likely to be guilty of a violent crime than other Dutch. And of course, that brings to mind something else which I'll briefly touch on, although it's not mentioned in this article. But we were talking the other week, Kel, about the Law and Freedom Foundation report concerning Muslim sex slavery. And the writers of that report noted that Muslims were 154 times more likely to be involved in that kind of activity than were non-Muslims. And of course, this was in the face of people who were trying to sweep the grooming activity under the carpet, which they'd been trying to do for 25 years, quite successfully by accusing the local population of racism and Islamophobia and saying, well, sex slavery or grooming activities, as they called it, weren't just the preserve of Muslims. Non-Muslims did it as well. Well, okay, non-Muslims may have been involved to a certain extent, but when Muslims themselves are involved to an extent of 154 times as much, it's time to ask some hard questions. And going back to this particular article, where in Holland, Muslims are 22 times more likely to be guilty of a violent crime than other Dutch, and going back to the statistics that the Independent was relating, which is Muslims that make up 4.5% of the population, but 14% of the offenders. It is clear that there has to be something at the bottom of it, but it is certainly not Islamophobia. It's certainly not that the population is acting because they have the spotlight on them, in the way that you might say, give a dog a bad name and he'll live up to it. The fact is that the Islamic ideology does not recognize a lot of these basic Islamic activities as crimes. And I mean, the particular example that I referred to from the Law and Freedom Foundation concerning sex slavery, it's actually part of the Quran. The so-called Prophet Muhammad himself took sex slaves, and he is in the Quran, chapter 33, verse 21. He is to be emulated as the most perfect person who ever lived. So it's not surprising that when Muslims try to emulate his lifestyle, they run into trouble, because a lot of the things that the so-called Prophet Muhammad did during his life were thoroughly reprehensible. And if he were alive today, he would either be in an institution for the criminally insane, or he'd be hung up from a lamppost and tarred and feathered. You know, and I'd pay good money to see that, I ought to say, ladies and gentlemen. But moving right back to the article, I'll hand it over back to you, Kel, to carry on.
Bring your popcorn or your bacon bits. Bring your knitting. But yeah, we have another one here, and who is this one? Where is he? Amel Imad of the charity Muslim Aid. Poor little baby. Amel Imad of the charity Muslim Aid suggested that poor educational performance problems, finding fulfilling jobs, and family breakdown were factors in the increasing number of Muslims behind bars. She said, it may be that they can't integrate into society. They don't think they have a positive chance to integrate into society. Oh, my. Okay, you know what? What about this, though, Amel Imad? But why are these young Muslims having poor educational performances? And, Tim, I love this point. There is not an issue within the Hindu nor the Sikh society. Nobody else from South Asia, for example, has any issues. And Muslims are not Asians, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. And the UK Asians that are listening to this program, please sue your local media outlet for labeling Muslims as Asians and giving you a bad rap. But could it be that Amel Imad chooses not to see the problems caused to their own people by Islamic theological, cultural, and social patterns? Now, the effect of the genetic disaster of Islamic cousin marriages, the separatism, the hostility towards the host non-Muslim community are all factors as to why Muslims are more likely than some other similar groups to end up committing crimes. I'm sorry, Amel, but those of us who have had the misfortune to observe Islamic society in Britain close up. So we can see you are talking bullshit. Yay! Wonderfully said.
Yeah, quite so. I mean, he doesn't mention it in that paragraph, but the hostility towards the host non-Muslim community has its origins in Islamic political ideology, which is to say Islamic ideology, and in the Quran. And I refer my learned listeners back to what I said earlier, which is that it's the duty of every devout Muslim to do everything in their power, be it ever so small, in order to advance the cause of Islam at the expense of Dar al-Harb. And that's why we see what we're seeing, unremitting hostility towards the host non-Muslim community because they are non-Muslims. And it doesn't matter how much money you throw at the problem, you will never make, it comes back to what I was saying about hearts and minds, you are never going to get the Muslims, as when I'm talking about the community as a whole. Obviously there may well be one in or one or more individual Muslims out there who don't necessarily subscribe to what I'm saying, instance, they're not really the devout Muslims that I'm talking about. They are Muslims in name only. But for devout Muslims, they are never going to be anything but hostile towards the host non-Muslim community. And again, the Quran tells them, you must not take friends, you must not become friends with any Muslims. I think that's Quran chapter 5, verse 51. And that you may smile in the face of a non-Muslim, even if your heart has enmity towards them. And that principle is an overriding principle that governs the behavior of devout Muslims towards non-Muslims. And when they tell you it ain't so, well, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, listeners, but they're actually indulging in taqiyya. And believe it or not, taqiyya is something I've had occasion to read up about in the last couple of months. I won't go into that now. I'll leave my listeners to guess why that might be. But the overriding principle is not to be anything but hostile, and that is why we see what we see.
Oh, yeah, and it's amazing to me that the mainstream media, they don't really care about this a whole lot, but we do. And there's people in the chat room saying that, you know, if I were an Asian, I would be complaining, and I would be filing my lawsuits as well. So, but we've got another one here that just is not getting it. And who is this person here? This is Mr. No. Whiners, all of them. This is Ms. Noor Ram, a spokesman for the organization Muslim Prisoners. I think that should read for the organization of Muslim prisoners. I'm not too sure, but I'm not playing grammar queen. I just play one on the radio. Okay. He blamed the spike on Islamophobia and racism among police officers. Now, the rebuttal. This statement is incredibly easy to dismiss. Far from the British police having a downer on the ideology of Islam, they seem to have a downer on those who are opposed to the ideology of Islam. Ram's statement flies smack into the face of evidence when you consider how Islamic child rape gangs were allowed to operate virtually unhindered in many different police areas for nearly 20 years. There is no Islamophobia in the British police. If anything, the police pander far too much to the followers of Islam. There are many British people of all skin colors and all religions and none who would quite like the British police to get a whole lot more Islamophobic on these bastard arses. See, I love this article.
Yes. Well, no, I mean, he's making a very good point. I mean, I have first-hand experience of this, as I'm sure our listeners are now aware, that the police will go out of their way to investigate perceived well, I say racial offences, because, of course, Islam is not a race and Muslims are not a racial group. They should not be classified as racial offences at all. But nevertheless, that's still how the media portrays it. But even if you accept that Islam is a religion, which I don't, not first and foremost anyway, you can hardly say that the police are acting in a way that discriminates against followers of Islam in any respect. They will go out of their way if a Muslim phones up and says, well, I've just had a cross wrapped in ham left at my front door. It's out with the SWAT teams and the police dogs and the helicopters with the, it's all 24/7 guards on the corner of their street to make sure that the heinous crime does not reoccur. I mean, that's just one example, okay? And I'm not kidding about that particular offence. Somebody who did complain about having a cross left in ham, wrapped in ham and left on their doorstep was actually treated to a 24/7 patrol in their neighbourhood to make sure that they were reassured and that the likelihood of it reoccurring was minimised. Well, that would be fine if only that the police would take a similar attitude when it comes to Muslim criminal behaviour and coming down very heavily on those Muslims who exhibit racial or religious and anti-Muslim activity, which they frequently do, of course. I mean, we get accused a great deal of the time for being racist and Islamophobic. But I have to say that when it comes to racism, Muslims, you know, they could compete in the Olympics for racism and, you know, clean up on gold, silver and bronze. So,
and they could win Nobel Peace Prizes.
Well, you never know. That's right. Nobel Peace Prizes. That's right. They could clean up on those, I'm quite sure.
Could have their own space program.
Well, indeed. Yeah, they could do
and
that.
And we wouldn't have to shut down NASA to make the Muslims feel a little better about themselves. Man, you're right, Tim. The potential is amazing.
That's right.
This article, though, I mean, this is unreal. And there goes my voice again. I'm just going to go to sidebar for a minute, Tim, and tell you that I was on a radio show. Well, I'm not on a radio show. I produce for another radio show, and I don't even produce. I'm just there. I'm the window dressing. I take care of the studio, and I take care of the chat room, and that is Conservative Outcry with the Rooster, and that's the Rooster Crows at Night, right? And so he had his show on Saturday night, and he decided that he wanted to have me incorporated in the dialogue. And so there was Rooster, there was Stanger, and there was myself, and we were talking about the issues of Islam. I was getting so animated, Rooster said, "Kel, will you please quit inhaling on the helium balloon?" Yes, Rooster.
Yeah.
I know. People know when I'm animated. My voice goes higher and higher, but this just outrages me. It really does. And just to close out this article, I'm just going to read verbatim what the author of the article said. He said, "I'm not surprised to see the Indy carrying this Islamic wine fest, and neither am I surprised to see that they are not asking any of the awkward questions that need to be asked about the subject. There is no mention, for example, of the admittedly small but growing number of originally non-Muslim child molesters who are converting to Islam while in prison on the grounds that Muslims are less likely to want to chop up a nonce than the non-Muslim prison population." I love that. "There was no mention of the insidious practice of prison conversion, where Afro-Caribbean prisoners are being invited, quote-unquote, to become Muslim whilst in prison, for reasons of protection, and then these new Muslims begin being co-opted into Muslim gangs when they leave prisons. Now, if Muslims are making up 1 in 7 in our prison population, then doesn't that indicate which proportion of Britain's Muslim guests are likely to be a potential problem for the future? So the 1 in 20 of our population, which is Muslim, is creating 1 in 7 in our prisoners. Those figures are not the fault of racism or adverse discrimination. They are the fault of the Muslims themselves, and this has not anything to do with the Islamawaners that they can pass off as somebody else's fault." And I agree with that.
Well, yes. I mean, the conclusion is inescapable. It isn't Islamophobia, and it's not the fault of racism. It's not the fault of adverse discrimination at all, as the article says. Muslims are responsible for what is happening. And if they were honest with themselves, which, of course, they are not, they would hold their hands up or at least look in a mirror and say, maybe we've got a problem here with our ideology. Maybe our ideology isn't best designed for assimilating and integrating into Western society. Maybe we should be honest and upfront about this and admit this to the non-Muslims who have been so kind as to invite us into their countries. What do you think the chances are of that happening, Kel, before I go on? Do you think those chances are good? You know, medium, non-existent, perhaps?
You make me laugh. You amuse me.
Well, I'm always glad to be of service, Kel, in that department, as you
know.
No,
I don't mean that in the denigrating sense. That you're so clever. You're so very clever the way you put things. It's fantastic. There's very, very little that I disagree with. When you open your mouth and say something, I'm usually nodding my head in agreement, so it's very hard for me to. But, yeah, I mean, absolute insanity, though, in that they're trying to blame Islamophobia. And I love this article. I love this article so much. I think I'm going to tweet Fahrenheit 211 to personally thank them for it, because it's brilliant, well written, and close to the truth. Well, it's not close to the truth, Tim. It's bang on the money. So once again, Fahrenheit 211, thank you very much for that. Oh, and we have a caller, Tim.
Oh, okay.
Let's bring this guy on. Hi, 4707. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Kel and Tim, this is the Schmeagle.
Hey, Schmeagle, how you doing?
I'm looking for my precious. Give it to me.
Ha ha. Well, now, if you're looking for your precious, you might have to answer a question. And now, let's see, Kel, do you think you might have the answer to that question?
What did you say, Smeagol? What was the answer?
What's the question?
Oh, excuse me. I'm going to just mute myself for a moment. I've just spurted my tea out my nose. Just excuse me for a moment. I'll be right back.
Smeagol? Do you have the answer to our trivia question for today?
Six. The answer is six.
No, that's not it. But what do you mean? Are you looking for your ring again?
The ring is in the fire. The precious is in the fire. Precious is the precious does the precious root. Goodbye, Cal.
When are you going to... Well, you know what? Don't touch my rings, okay? And for God's sake, will you please, when you call in, have a shower? You are living in that swamp and you stink.
Well, that's no way to treat our guest, Kel. I mean, I would have thought it might be nice if nobody else is able to answer the trivia question today. It might be nice to actually make a donation to somebody who touches our hearts in some way on this show, and I think Schmeagol actually makes a very good candidate for that. What do you think, Kel?
Yeah, I agree, Tim. Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, how about this then? A coffee mug could be quite a good place for somebody to keep their precious if they actually manage to find it and they don't want to lose it again. You know, I mean, that's what I do with all my important things. They always end up in coffee mugs on my shelf. So, you know, that could be our contribution to Schmeagol not losing his precious next time. What do you think?
I think that's a wonderful idea. You know what? I think that's a wonderful idea.
Okay. What does Schmeagol think about it? What does Schmeagol think of the mendacious grievance-mongering Takiya artist coffee mug to keep his precious in? He's thinking about it.
Oh, Schmeagol's call dropped.
Oh, no. Well, I tell you what, if he calls...
He lost connection with the Middle Earth.
If he calls back in, maybe we can get his opinion on that and perhaps box him up a mendacious grievance-mongering Takiya artist coffee mug and see what he thinks of it.
Well, maybe Schmeagol can try to call back in. I don't know what his long-distance plan is like over there in Middle Earth there, Tim. It must be a lousy one.
Yeah, it might
obviously
probably Verizon.
Yeah, You know, Schmeagle, you really have to stop using the Carrier 72 versions. Like, you know, they're not a very good they're not a very good carrier for long distance calls. You know what? Go with Verizon because I can hear you now. And believe me, if you are calling from Middle Earth, Verizon will get you right through, right away, right quick, right all the time. Right, Tim? Right.
Oh, yeah.
I had a door in the chat room, sir, and cut him off.
Yeah, so Agador says Sauron is still pissed off because he lost his contact lens. Very good.
Oh, Vorpal here, you know what? Vorpal, let's give out the trivia question again because we've got 20 minutes and there's plenty of time for people to call in and answer it. Go up into the slides and there's going to be a picture there. There's a picture of a happy couple holding their new baby. It is not Prince George. What are they holding? What is the name of the cat? Call in. And call in at 347-237-4318, or you can skippity Skype in. The Skype button's at the top of the chat page. What is the name of the cat that the happy couple is holding? And if you know who the happy couple is, I might throw in a little bonus with the coffee mug. So there you go. And Forb in the chat room is, what the hell kind of question is that?
I don't know. I know people want it all on a plate, don't they, these days, Kel? You know, there's a little bit of hard work and a little bit of diligent research and can't be bothered, I don't know. But yeah, if anybody's got the answer, you know, a mendacious grievance mongering tequila artist coffee mug could be winging its way to you tonight.
So come on, guys. We've got 20 minutes left. Tim, where's the time going? Holy smokes.
Yeah, but, I know. It's
shocked off, isn't maybe we'll get Schmeagle back. I don't know. But we'll wait and see what happens. But, yeah, I'm glad you sent this article, though, from Fahrenheit 211. I really like these guys. I really love this website. Guys, bookmark this website because it's just absolutely brilliant, and the articlists are fantastic. But there's another website, too, that I think you should go to. And, of course, that is Liberty GB. And, hey, Tim.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Sorry, what's that, Kel? Say that last bit again, please.
Don't you write for them as well?
I do indeed. I've dropped an article in on Liberty GB.
Oh, there, you know what? I just went to the site, and guess what they just put up in there? Tim Burton in Birmingham Mercury.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's
and there's your picture. Oh, I'm putting this in the chat room. Hey, folks, click on this. Get to see what Tim looks like, too.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, that's good, because I didn't realize they had actually done that. So that'll be nice. Let's have a look and see what it's like.
Brilliant.
I was actually very pleasantly surprised at what they put. Oh yeah, very good. I was very pleasantly surprised at what they put in the Sunday Mercury, and I did think that they might be slightly harder on me because at the end of the day, Birmingham has a very large Muslim population and they might feel that they need to write articles that sympathise. But no, the person that wrote the article was very fair and even-handed, in my opinion. So I was very pleasantly surprised. So yeah, if anybody wants to take a look at that particular article, they've taken my scanned picture and they've put it on the website, so I'm very pleased. God, I wish I'd put more makeup on before I let them have that photograph. But there you go, we can't have everything.
Makeup.
No, well, I say makeup. I mean, you know, three of sand and one of cement would have been good. Just plaster it on all over, fill in the cracks. But there you go. That's the ravages of age. Nothing much to be done about it now, I feel.
Oh, this is just brilliant, though. I think they must have just posted this well, they posted at 17:48. What time is that? That's military time. Oh, I get so 7 p.m. Oh, going on 8 p.m. your time.
2 or 3 hours ago. So that's really good. So if anybody from Liberty GB is listening, thank you very much for posting that, because I did wonder what I was going to do to actually get the picture up on a website. I never thought of asking Liberty GB themselves to do it, but there you go. They're one step ahead of me all the time, so that's all good news. Interesting.
Fantastic.
Well, if you look at the name of the reporter at the top of the article, he's a chap called Amadeep Bassi. And my first reaction was, is he Shirley Bassey's brother? But no, that wasn't my first reaction. My first reaction was, I do hope he's not a Muslim reporter. But apparently the name Amadeep has Sikh origins, and it turns out that he is indeed a Sikh. I think that's probably a good thing, because if I'd got somebody reporting on that and it turned out his name was something like Mohammed Morsi or something like that, I might have had occasion to worry. But the article, as I say, I think is very fair. All the facts were presented as they actually are. All kudos to the Sunday Mercury in Birmingham for presenting the article in the way that they did. So, yeah, that's it.
There you go. Sorry, I put you on speaker because we have somebody in the chat room who's not quite sure about the trivia question.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Got you back. Yeah, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't have to name the couple. I think the couple is pretty self-explanatory. They're rather famous. Let me see. One of them in the photograph is the heir to the British throne, so we kind of, you know, that's a given. But who is the cat? What is the cat's name? What is the baby cat's name? Now, everybody knows this happy couple gave birth to a bouncing baby boy last summer, and he is Prince George, but we want to know who is the cat. What is the name of the cat? And Google searches are acceptable.
Vorpal Bite is not too happy with all this. I'm just looking in the chat room. And Vorpal Bite says, I don't know who those people are, and I don't really care. So I thought that was rather good, but we haven't had a correct answer yet. I think we might have made the trivia question slightly too hard this week, Cal. What do you think? I would have thought they would have jumped on that and picked up on that cat's name very easily, but apparently not.
Yeah, we'll switch it around next week. But that's okay. You know what? Because we've got coffee mugs, and they're sitting here. And if we don't have a winner this week, Tim, that's okay. We'll have a winner next week or the week later. It doesn't matter.
Yes, indeed.
But
yeah.
Here we go. We are nearly closing out this show. I cannot believe where the time is going. But there is something I wanted to bring up with you as well. And I bookmarked this. And this is regarding kosher meals in American prisons, and this was written by Alan Kornman, and he is the Monday host here on our Radio Jihad. But he wrote this article about how much kosher meals for inmates would cost in Florida, and they assessed it at $14.9 million a year. Okay, now what is the issue with that? Well, it's because they're kosher meals. And everybody is like, well, you know, my tax dollars going towards kosher meals. My argument is, where are you when it's halal meals? Whenever Muslims make demands, especially in the prison system, Tim, and we'll stick with that theme, is that nobody says a word. But when the Jewish population says, hey, I want my kosher meal, well, all of a sudden, it's headline news. I don't get this, and neither does Alan Kornman. And I was looking down this article, And it was, I'll put it in the chat room for everybody as well. I was looking down this article, and I was amazed about the concern regarding the cost for serving kosher meals. What is, what is the deal? We've got a, you know what? I think I have time for this, Tim, but there's a clip here, and I want to play it, and this is an imam talking about special dietary needs in the prison system. Here, hang on. Take a listen to this.
Behind prison walls, inmates don't have a lot of input. For the most part, they take what's given to them. But when it comes to meals, they are putting up a fight and have now found support in court.
It is a very frustrating issue.
The issue is religious meals for inmates. Florida is now under court order to start serving kosher food to Jewish inmates. A costly change.
It's a little over $2 a meal for a regular prison meal. It's around $7 for a kosher meal.
Which can add up to more than $40 million a year, according to estimates from the Department of Correction given to Senator Rob Bradley.
I am stunned by the numbers. It's incredible that it costs this much.
It's his job to keep track of the numbers as chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees prisons.
And that's taxpayer dollars that could be spent educating our kids, paying our teachers more, improving our roads, providing better medical care for Floridians.
Well, religious rights don't stop at the prison gate.
Chaplain Gary Friedman is the chairman of Jewish Prisoner Services International.
This has been going on with Florida now for at least 12 years that I've been involved with it. And it's gone back and forth and back and forth, and it's long, long overdue.
Friedman lives in Seattle, Washington. He says his home state and a few dozen others have offered religious meals for years, and not just kosher.
I'm concerned about the fact that we might find ourselves having to tailor meals to every single religious experience and taste.
Which is exactly what's now happening.
Then by that same token, we believe that they should offer the same accommodation to Muslim inmates and actually all inmates, regardless of their religious affiliation.
Hassan Shibli says the Council on American-Islamic Relations has made this issue a priority in Florida in 2014.
And the cost? Frankly, it's something we can afford, I think, as a society to ensure that people are properly fed.
So what is properly fed?
For Muslim prisoners, the kind of meal they can eat is basically food which has been slaughtered properly with the name of God by a practicing Jew, Muslim, or Christian, and that doesn't include any pork in it.
It's called halal meals.
Halal food is actually about half the cost, if not a third of the cost of kosher food. So if they can afford to offer kosher food to Jewish inmates, we certainly believe they can offer halal food to Muslim inmates.
These are individuals who have been convicted of a crime and are serving their debt to society, and so this isn't supposed to be a spa hotel experience.
Doug Smith, Fox 35 News.
The emergency court order just went into effect requiring Florida to provide religious meals, but it's not over. The issue is scheduled for trial coming up this August for the state, so the state plans to fight it. Glenn?
Oh, shut the hell up already, these prisoners, these whinging and they whining and they're wanting this and they're wanting that. And the chat room is just going nuts over this, Tim. And it's true. You know what? You decided to recuse yourself from society by committing crimes. I don't want to pay for your halal. I don't want to pay for your kosher. I don't want to pay for your vegan diets. I don't want to do any of that, and I don't think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people kind of frown on special dietary needs. Now, I have no issue with the Hindus because they're vegetarian. I have no issue with the Jews because they do have kosher needs. But I do have an issue with the halal because the way that the animals are slaughtered in the halal practice, Tim, that bothers me. But this all the same, Tim. What on earth is this?
Prison is supposed to be punishment, of course, and I think that if somebody finds themselves in prison, I noticed that one of the arguments that was put into that article was that if one of the inmates said that if he didn't get the food prepared according to his religious specifications, or at least his lawyer said this, then his client's soul might suffer. And the person who was writing the article quite rightly said, I wonder if his soul suffered at the time that he was slaughtering his parents, because that's what he was in prison for. I mean, I shouldn't really be laughing as I'm saying this, but it is quite ridiculous on its face we're paying them all this attention when they are supposed to be in prison to suffer punishment. I mean, of course, you can expect people like CARE to jump on the bandwagon and say, well, if Jews can have kosher food, then of course why can't Muslims have halal food? But we described, didn't we, on a previous show, or we talked with Dr. Bill Warner on the subject of necessity versus obligation. And certainly in the case of Muslims, they can eat anything at all. It doesn't have to be halal food whatsoever. And Dr. Bill Warner made the case that if a Muslim was on a life raft, adrift in the middle of the ocean, and all he had to eat was tins of Spam, always assuming, of course, that he had a tin opener, then all he had to do was to invoke the principle of necessity trumping obligation, which is to say, if he didn't eat at all, he would die, but Allah would prefer it that he kept himself alive through whatever means, and if it meant eating pork products, then that was perfectly okay with Allah. And that principle, of course, should apply in a prison, where if the prison authorities say, no, we're not going to cater to your halal requirements, you will eat this or you can starve, then the Muslim prisoner is quite capable of saying to himself, well, if the Kufar authorities say this and the choice is either me starving or eating a pork-based product or at least a non-halal product, then I'll eat it. Thank you very much. And we should be less solicitous, certainly of Muslim requirements in this area, because of the principle of necessity trumping obligation. Now, I'm not quite sure whether it's exactly the same for kosher meals, but I certainly would say that we shouldn't be giving in to Muslims on halal meals, because they do have an exemption from Allah if the necessity arises, because the necessity trumps the obligation.
Absolutely. And you know what? This is something that we should explore further and probably do that next week, because this is this could be a fascinating discussion on its own, and that a special accommodation within our prison systems and the Muslims and the Jewish population and their demands. They are in prison for a reason, ladies and gentlemen. And there's a lot of people in the chat room, Tim, that are saying that they don't want to pay for them, period.
Well, yeah, I can quite understand that.
Let them starve.
Yeah. I mean, we can elaborate on this a little further in a show down the road, Kel, because I only mentioned this because we're coming up to the close of the show, and I didn't want you to overrun, but it's a subject that has generated a lot of interest in the chat room, and maybe we should schedule a full show to discuss it in more detail further down the line.
Okay, well, let's do that then. And, of course, we want to thank Dodgy Dave and Verbal Bite that also joined us in the chat room, and thank everybody who well, I mean, you listen to Tim and you put up with me, and so I thank you.
Oh, Kel, you're too modest. I tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, if it wasn't for Kel, you wouldn't have a whole series of wonderfully produced Blog Talk Radio productions virtually every day of the week. So although she's suitably deferential, she does a wonderful job. And I really do take my hat off. She's a wonderful producer and a wonderful co-host. In fact, the best co-host a red-blooded male could wish for. So don't listen to her when she says that it's all down to me, because, of course, it isn't. Kel, you're doing a wonderful job, and I love you for it.
Oh, thanks, Tim. Absolutely. And just to remind people that we are going into April, a week tomorrow, Tim goes to the magistrate in Birmingham, and please try to be there. If you are in the Birmingham, UK area, please try to be at the courthouse 10 a.m. British summertime, and Liberty GB, they'll have placards for you too. You don't have to bring your own placards, because Liberty GB will be supplying them. Support the Birmingham one, free the Birmingham one, and donate to the Birmingham one. This is costing Tim a pretty penny, and believe me, I cannot afford to lose my co-host. Okay, because if he is thrown into insolvency, well, I'll cry.
Yeah, if you have a few spare pennies, please donate. I've just put the link in again into the chat room. What am I talking
right
about?
On.
If you can spare a few pennies, what I really mean is sell your house, sell your car, sell your dog, pawn your wife's jewelry. No, sell your wife, and make sure that money, once you've liquidated it, goes straight to the Cat Strangler 101 Defence Fund by the fastest means possible. So that's my little advert for tonight, and I look forward to seeing
right
you all
on.
Next week.
Absolutely. Tim, thank you so very much. Have yourself a wonderful evening.
Yes, indeed. See you soon,
ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us. We will see you next week, same time, same place, and we will see you tomorrow night, Freedom Loving Infidels on Radio Jihad Network, 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And there you go. Good night, Tim.
Yeah, good night, Kel, and good night, everybody in the chat room. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
Oh, another slow startup.
Keep hope alive. I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope alive.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, want your foolish pride, want your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar will look like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Minds made into a beautiful toy, and at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats gave you the strength of a thousand men, gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them, and you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna fall. Some harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Well, here's to you, two shots of whiskey, one Jameson, one Johnny Powers, from Coney Island to Seaside Heights, Long Beach, Freeport, the Lower East Side, mass of people, the sheep's head.